Get ready for the greatest roast of all time. The Roast of Tom Brady. A Netflix live event happening May 5th. Hosted by Kevin Hart. The seven-time world champion gets his cleats held to the fire by famous friends and frenemies on an unforgettable night where everything is fair game. Tune in on May 5th at 5 p.m. Pacific time for The Roast of Tom Brady. Live only on Netflix.
Variant Podcast Works. This is Chuck Smith. I'm here to bring you our flagship show. Yep, it's just me flying solo, but I'm happy to be doing it because, of course, with Bayern Munich, even on break, there's a lot to talk about. But the resurgent German national team has also provided fans with some reason for hope and a lot of discussion points. So that's where I want to start. And if you had a chance to listen to the post-game show, which I hosted and had Jack Lauschway on, from BFW. We broke down our initial thoughts, what our quick hit reactions were to Germany's 2-0 victory over France. And we went into it, and Jack had a lot of great points. I thought it was his first time on Bavarian Podcast Works. He has been with BFW for quite some time now, but he had not been on the podcast. I thought he made a lot of good observations about the match. But after having a day to really sit back, assess things after, you know, a good period of time, rewatch some parts of the game, I'll tell you, there was a lot of good to take away from it. And I know, listen, everybody wants to be excited about it. I want to be excited about it. And the one thing I think everyone was looking for against France was just any reason to be excited. I know for me, the bare minimum for me, what I needed to see was a creative attack. I needed to see some control in the midfield and a stable back line. And I will tell you this, I thought we saw at least a little bit of all of those things. Obviously, the attack, I thought, functioned really well against a good France side. The midfield with Toni Kroos, I mean, and Robert Andrich, I thought they did a tremendous job. I really do. The more I got to see Andrich, and I thought he was in at my initial first pass of it, I thought he had a decent game. I thought there were some things about the way he performed I didn't like. However, you know, taking some time and sitting back, I thought he complimented Toni Kroos really well. And he allowed Kroos to do what he does, which is really facilitate, really set up the attack and use his pinpoint passing and his intelligence to create offense. Now, the first big thing I wanted to really talk about and dive into was Toni Kroos. Now, obviously, I was a person who I have always thought Toni Kroos was a tremendous player. No matter how he left Bayern Munich, what the back and forth was at the time between he and Uli Hoeneß, none of that really matters to me. Bottom line, I'm going to look at him as a footballer. And I thought, for the large majority of his career, he has just been tremendous, a top shelf midfielder, someone you would want on any team. However, toward the end of his last run with the German national team, he had become almost aloof on the field. He looked apathetic. He looked like he didn't care about anything that was going on. He didn't look like he wanted to help provide a solution to everything that was ailing the squad. And he wasn't the only one. I mean, we saw over the course of time under Yogi Love that, you know, Thomas Müller, Mats Hummels, and Jerome Boateng all got chopped out of that mix. And nothing quite seemed to work. And when Hansi Flick came back, it was really the time for Toni Kroos to make his exit. And I thought at that point, that would be the last we had seen of him. Now, he had done some tremendous things, obviously, in his club career. You go back to 2014, he was part of that mix that won the World Cup. He had done everything that he needed to do. He had dumped in all of the blood, sweat, and tears you could ask of anyone. But at that point, he stepped away, and I thought this was the right time. He looked like, not that the game had passed him by, but just that it wasn't for him anymore. That this wasn't the type of group that he was going to be able to work with, and maybe that both Germany and Toni Kroos needed to move on and move away from each other. And I think they did. And I think that that was what was needed for Toni Kroos at the time. Now, though, you look at what Germany needed. In the midfield, they needed some stability. They needed a veteran presence with vision and leadership. They needed someone who maybe wasn't going to be the biggest vocal leader, but someone that was going to instill confidence in the rest of the unit by the way he was playing, by what he was seeing, by the plays he would be able to make. So while I was really not sure about how this would work, and I wasn't, like, as much as I value Kroos and how much I think he is a phenomenal player, I really didn't want him coming back to the German national team because I just felt like it was the time to move on. Why keep going back in the past? And the last memories I had of him were basically not him not being fully engaged in what was going on. And maybe I read that situation wrong, and maybe he was, and maybe just wasn't working out for him or whatever. But what I do know is with him coming back, he looked like a completely different player. He looked more engaged. He looked like he was fully into it. And obviously it helps when he is sent in the pass that leads to the opening goal just 7 seconds into the match. Yeah, of course, you look great at that point. But he did so many good things throughout the match. It makes Julian Nagelsmann look really smart for going out and pursuing Toni. I mean, what else would you want from him other than what he did? To me, it was the perfect way to come back and to beat France, which, you know, listen, I predicted a tie in the game. I never would have assumed that Germany would be able to come out, blank France on their home turf, and really put in the kind of performance where they got better as the game went along. If anything, I expected Germany to fade a little bit, to maybe come out strong and then fade, but they didn't. They actually got way stronger in the second half. And sure, there were some lulls and some bad moments toward the end of the match, but this was a very, very good effort. I know it sounds premature to get super excited, and I'm not going to anoint them anything. It was a very good first step in what is going to be a not so long journey to get to the Euros. So we'll see what happens and how they build on that France victory. And Toni Kroos undoubtedly will be a big part of that. Another big factor in that match, obviously, was the play of Florian Wirtz and Jamal Musiala. Now, for Musiala, we have seen him do this before. Sure, he hasn't been at his best on the club scene for Bayern Munich this season. And in fact, you could go back to last year's World Cup where he really, I thought, struggled and never got back on track. You would see glimpses here and there, but we didn't just see that energetic, successful Musiala. And it's not to say that he didn't have good moments for Bayern Munich here or there, but there was a lot of repetitive mistakes, a lot of poor decisions that we had not become accustomed to, because when he burst onto the scene at Bayern Munich, I mean, the kid was an enigma. He was smart and fast and decisive and could create so much offense for himself and everyone else. You didn't see much of the downside. But after that World Cup, I believe that his confidence took a hit during it, and it just did carry, and it was over top of him like a black cloud. And at times he would be able to shake that off and show you how brilliant he was. And then at other times, he became very frustrating. And in many ways, was one of the poster children for all the things that have went wrong at Bayern Munich this season. You just didn't see enough of that great Musiala. But we did start to see that over the past couple of weeks at Bayern. And then, of course, with how he played against Germany versus France. And I don't think it is really all that much of a coincidence that this all coincides with Musiala bumping out, playing in a more wide position. Now, for both Germany and France, he's not exactly playing on the sideline, right? He's playing almost a more narrow wing, more of a wide forward than a traditional winger. But whatever the case, it's working. It gets him out of the middle where he tends to get beat up and where he tends to make worse decisions, quite frankly. And to have him out there being impactful for both Germany and Bayern Munich right now, playing in that wider position, I think it's a no-brainer. I think both organizations need to convince him this is the spot for you because this is where you're best. And I'm not saying this to pat myself on the back because I have been beating this drum for 3 years now, but I just think it makes sense on so many levels right now for Bayern Munich and for Germany to keep him out there. And for not the least of which reason is that Florian Wirtz being on the other side, playing opposite of Jamal Musiala, it looked sensational. Now, you did have Ilkay Gundogan, who I didn't think was all that impactful in the middle, but for some reason, it just all worked and clicked together. And I wouldn't say Gundogan had any type of great game against France, but he didn't really need to. He just needed not to screw up, to be honest. And he did a good job of that. So when you have the dynamic presence of both Wirtz and Musiala creating offense, striking fear into the opposition's back line, and this was not an inexperienced back line for France. I mean, with the likes of Luca Hernandez, Benjamin Pavard, Dia Upamecano, among others, I mean, this was a very talented France defensive unit. And when you include the midfield and some of the names that they had there, listen, Musiala and Wirtz showed exactly why they are two of the most promising talents on earth. They did something that I wasn't quite sure they would be able to do at this stage, and that's completely take over a game and dominate what I would consider the best international side on earth in France. I mean, I think France, top to bottom, when they're healthy, is the best team. But they had no answer for Musiala and Wirtz, and that is such a key for Julian Nagelsmann moving forward. Who can put together a defense or a midfield defense combo that can stop those two? Sure, it's possible. But when those two are clicking at their best and they're confident and they're playing fast and they're playing so dynamic and creating so much offense, I mean, that was a pleasure to watch. And if anything, you want to take anything out of it, that is the reason you should be excited, because I wasn't sure that Florian Wirtz was going to be able to elevate his game for Germany. We had seen him do it for Bayer Leverkusen. And in fact, this has been an entire season of him taking his level and making it go higher and higher and higher over the course of this season. But now with Germany, we had not seen that. He had always looked uncomfortable, always looked unsettled. But now he looks so good. And it's one game, yes. But if they can build from that, if Nagelsmann can continue to get Musiala and Wirtz to be those disruptive presences that we want them to be, this really could amount to something. And regardless of who plays at striker, whether it's Kai Havertz or Niklas Füllkrug or Dennis Undav, it doesn't really matter, because if you have those two breaking down defenses like they were able to against France, anybody's going to be able to tap the ball into the net at that point. So I'm really looking forward to that. Florian Wirtz, man, I was so impressed with him and how he handled that situation. Same for Jamal Musiala. The only reason it didn't strike me as much for Musiala is because I had seen this before from him, both for Germany and for Bayern Munich. And while we had seen Wirtz do that so many times in the club scene, we had never seen him do this for Germany. So huge kudos to those two. Imagine how good they can be in 3 or 4 years if they stay healthy and keep clicking together like they have. One of the other big things that absolutely needs to be talked about from that match is the play of Joshua Kimmich. Now, Kimmich, I thought at times in the first half, while the numbers would indicate he really dominated the match against Kylian Mbappe, I thought he did have some struggles with Mbappe at times. Overall for the match, though, what can you say? Kimmich, from the start to the finish, played a huge role in Mbappe not being able to score, which, if you're playing France, that's an accomplishment in and of itself. And Mbappe is that good. This is a very talented French side, obviously. So Kimmich being, not saying he was solely responsible for Mbappe, because no coach is stupid enough to put one player on Mbappe and hope for the best, but he played the biggest factor in stopping him, which was really encouraging. And it was mostly encouraging because Kimmich, for the first time maybe, and it's, I think this started a couple of weeks ago, when Bayern Munich moved him back to right back after a couple of so-so efforts, it looked like he was starting to buy into playing the position again. And we saw the story that he's taking some private training, some of which is specifically designed to ramp up his play at right back, since he was going to have to play there. The fact that he's investing his own personal time into that, and this is private training that does not occur on Sabanastraße. This is occurring in Munich at a different facility, where he is specifically training for this spot. So to see Kimmich make that investment of time, to keep burning and working harder like the machine that we've known him to be, and to come out and get the success that he had against Mbappe, and I'm not stupid enough to think that he was the only one that was responsible for it. I'm also not stupid enough to think that those two could play again tomorrow and Mbappe could get a hat trick. We know how that works with Mbappe. But for one day, which is all you needed, Kimmich was the man, and he did the job on Mbappe, and he was successful. So that's encouraging, not just for Germany, but for Bayern Munich. Now, why is that encouraging for Bayern Munich? Because, listen, I'm not so sure that Kimmich and right back aren't a match made in heaven that should be that way on the club scene. Now, I know Kimmich probably doesn't want to play there. Let's be honest. I think it's an ego thing. It's a prestige thing. I don't think that many people dream about playing right back, but I do think a lot of people dream of playing in the central midfield. And I think that does affect Kimmich, and I think that he wants to be known as someone who can excel wherever he is. But maybe what's best is that he goes back to right back. Maybe that is the best position for him, and maybe that's what would make Bayern Munich the strongest it can be. Hey, and let's face it, they did win a treble with him playing right back, at least playing right back there in the Champions League finale as Thiago and Leon Goretzka patrolled the central midfield. One of the stories from that season was Benjamin Pavard getting injured and Kimmich having to go back and play that spot. And he did so again against PSG, a team that featured Mbappe. He did so with aplomb. And let's be honest, it was, again, a huge reason why Bayern was able to be so successful back then. But maybe that's the case. Maybe he'll jump back and maybe he'll accept a role. And then this Bayern Munich lineup could be exceptionally strong next year. As for how he's looking with Germany, there's no reason to move him from the spot. The country does simply not have another right back nearly as good as Kimmich. So why mess with what's working? Kimmich should stay there. And that does help things in the central midfield, because even if Robert Andrich maybe falls back, maybe if Pascal Gross doesn't become the type of player that Nagelsmann wants him to be, you also have options with Leon Goretzka. You have options with Alexander Pavlovich. There are things that Nagelsmann can do if some of the players that are currently in the central midfield don't play up to the standard that Nagelsmann wants. So there are a lot of good things, and it all kind of stems from, in this situation, Kimmich's ability to play right back. And finally, the last thing I want to touch on from the match is Nagelsmann. Nagelsmann's such an interesting case, right? Because I look at the guy and I've seen him coach for years and he's constantly changing things and moving things around. And one of the things I theorized last week about was, maybe for all this time I've been thinking about this wrong with him, maybe in this format that is so crazy, maybe consistency doesn't work anymore. Maybe you do need to keep moving things around and changing things to keep your opponents off balance, to keep your team fresh, to keep everyone from becoming complacent. Maybe Nagelsmann was the guy that was needed at this moment to change everything that was going on at Germany. Maybe it was never Hansi Flick. Maybe the old ways weren't going to work anymore. Maybe they needed this man who, I would say, out-tinkered himself from a job at Bayern Munich. He just completely made so many changes and couldn't settle on anything that I do think it disrupted the locker room. It disrupted the front office. It turned everyone against him to the point where he got sacked. But here at Germany, he doesn't really have to be accountable to anyone or anything. For all we know, he's really considering himself an interim manager at this point. He's only with Germany through the Euros. So everything he's doing, people just have to accept it. The players have to accept it. The people overseeing him, his bosses, have to accept it. And he can go in and he can be as creative as he wants. He can make any of the changes that he wants. He can go out and pick the players that he wants. And there's nothing anybody can do about it. And maybe that's what was needed. Maybe that edge of not knowing how safe you would be as a player is what everyone needed to get back and refocused and to really seize the potential that was lying there dormant inside all of these German players. Maybe Nagelsmann's that guy. Maybe he's the perfect man for this time heading into the Euros. Because it's pretty tough to argue against it after that one game, right? And I know, don't get too excited. don't start the Nags train. For God's sakes, we're not doing hashtag Nags train like we did hashtag ARP train. We're not going to derail this thing yet, okay? But it definitely is a reason for fans to have some belief, like we talked about on that post-game show. And more than anything, that's what you all wanted. You wanted to have some belief, something to feel good about heading into the Euros. And now you got it. And the guy that's bringing it to you is Julian Nagelsmann. So that's some food for thought. We're going to take a quick break and we're going to come back and we're going to talk about one of the big news stories that dropped on Sunday. And that is Bayern Munich seems like they're giving Alphonso Davies an ultimatum, and we'll see how he responds. So hang with us. We'll be back to discuss that after this break.
You ready?
Showtime.
On May 3rd, summer starts with the Fall Guy.
What are you doing later?
Let's drink a spicy margarita.
Make some bad decisions.
Yes!
Audiences are falling in love with the most entertaining film of the year.
Fall Guy.
Fall Guy.
Fall Guy. That's what the poster said.
See Ryan Gosling and Emily Blunt in the movie critics say exists to make you happy.
Trying to make it out?
Nope.
Because I don't either. It's not what I'm into right now.
What are you into?
Talking.
Yeah.
The Fall Guy. Only in theaters May 3rd. Rated PG-13.
Hey, everybody. Welcome back to the Bavarian Podcast Work Show. This is Chuck Smith. I'm flying solo on this mission to bring you the latest and greatest Bayern Munich and German national team news. And of course, if you were paying attention to social media on Sunday, you got a very concerning note from Sky Sport journalist Florian Plettenberg, and I'll read it to you. This is news, hashtag Davies. FC Bayern want a decision from Davies next week. They want to know whether he will accept the new contract offered to him until 2029 with a total package of around 14 million salary gross per year, all in or not, meaning that they want to know if he's in. Davies and his management still demand about 20 million all in per season. If Davies doesn't accept Bayern's new offer, he will be up for sale next summer, meaning, of course, in a couple of weeks, really. Real Madrid are reluctant to pay anything close to 50 million and are determined to lower the price as much as possible. So we know that Bayern Munich has come to Davies with an offer of 13 million to 14 million in salary per year. We know that they have made this contract offer through 2029. That offers security. It offers a hell of a salary and it offers consistency and comfort. But none of that really might matter to Alphonso Davies. It does seem like he has his mind made up on a move to Real Madrid. Now, granted, we've seen Liverpool, Manchester City, and some others linked to him as well. But Real Madrid has been the one. And we know that his agent was in Spain, that he was talking to Real Madrid, that he talked to FC Barcelona. And we also know that Davies has had a fondness for Real Madrid. It's been there. There's been a big flirtation here. As they used to say on the Beverly Hillbillies, there's a little bit of a courting and a sparking going on, right? I think that was grandma that said that. Man, I'm really dating myself there, aren't I? Wow. Yeah. So anyway, watching the Beverly Hillbillies was not something that was necessarily in my time, but I believe when I was growing up in Philly, maybe it was Channel 17 would show that during the day. So if you were homesick, you got stuck and you would either watch, like, say, The Price is Right and all the game shows, or you would venture down to the UHF channels and you would watch like Hogan's Heroes and McHale's Navy and all of that kind of stuff. So Beverly Hillbillies was in that mix. That's how I know a Courtin and a Sparkin. I don't know how I got off on that tangent, but let's get back to Alphonso Davies. Anyway, with Davies, it does seem like he's really inclined to make this move. And I was actually probably one of the first people talking about this over a year ago that just didn't seem like Davies was in on Germany and on the Bundesliga, in on Bayern Munich, just because of the platform. And I never used it as a knock on him. It's just he's got a bigger picture idea of where he wants to be, what he wants his brand to be. You can't control that. This is what he wants, and it's his career, and he's going to make this move probably, most likely, based on that. And I think salary-wise, I don't know if he'll get much more than Bayern is offering at Real Madrid. but he will get their platform. He will get that worldwide acclaim, and he'll become a bigger brand. That is for sure. For Bayern fans, it will be bitter because we saw what Alphonso Davies could be. We saw the potential that he had. Now, if you want to criticize Davies, it's more than fair too. He has plateaued. He has not gotten any better over the last year and a half to 2 years. All that potential we saw has kind of been stagnated. And sure, you would probably argue that maybe some of the stuff he's doing off the field is playing a role in maybe why he hasn't made that progression. But maybe more important than how he's performed is how he could maybe get back on track in the future. And it will be a damn shame if he does that and it's not at Bayern Munich, because they invested in him at a time where he was a relative unknown. I mean, I've told this story before. I came across him watching the Canadian national team play, and I believe he came on as a sub, and I couldn't even tell you what year it was. And man, the kid just jumped off the screen for obvious reasons. He was electric. He was fast, dynamic. I mean, and he just disrupted things. And disruption is what I always look for. It's why it's one of my favorite words when you watch football. You want to see a player that's disruptive in a good way. And Davies is certainly that for many, many reasons. So as it stands, Bayern Munich now maybe has put out this ultimatum. Like, hey, you're going to have to let us know by next week if you're taking this offer or not, or we're going to move on. And who Bayern Munich gets at this point, it really doesn't matter. I mean, it does matter, but that's the least of the concern for many fans, because you still have a lot to play for. You still have two Champions League games at least left. You're going to play Arsenal. It's a matchup you could win, but does any of this affect anything? So if Davies rejects the ultimatum, he says he's not accepting it, from a front office standpoint, you could assume Bayern then moves on. They start to explore their options, maybe begin talks with certain clubs. But what happens on the pitch? Does Thomas Tuchel not use Alphonso Davies? Does he lean on Rafael Guerrero? What happens with all of that? I mean, it's a very tricky situation, because we've seen this work both ways, where when a player decides he's going to leave a club, sometimes the player continues on in his normal role. He excels. He at least fulfills his duties and then moves on. But we've also seen the scenarios where he becomes persona non grata and the club moves on from him before the end of his deal, before they can sell him. And I don't know how it's going to work out. I don't know how Thomas Tuchel, who was in a lame duck status of his own, is going to handle it. But it does present some interesting scenarios that could keep Bayern Munich fans on the edge of their respective seats, because Davies, when he's at his best, is that disruptive force who could make a difference in a tie against Arsenal, or maybe even later down the line against Real Madrid or Man City. But maybe he won't even have that opportunity. Maybe the way this is all played out will piss the bosses off enough that they'll throw down the mandate that he's not going to play. Now, I don't know if Tuchel would follow that kind of mandate. I don't know if Tuchel himself even rates Davies as high as he rates Rafael Guerrero at this point. I don't know. It's very difficult to tell, because there have been times where Davies has been healthy, and quite frankly, Tuchel's passed him over in favor of other players. So the Davies scenario will be a very sad moment if he opts to reject that contract offer from the Bavarians and he moves on. And from a club standpoint, it does take away some of the leverage. If Bayern Munich throws the ultimatum out and Davies rejects it, it automatically makes negotiating with a club like Real Madrid extremely hard, for two reasons. One, Madrid knows Davies wants out. They know that he's not going to accept the deal from Bayern Munich. So what is the incentive for them to pay the 50 to 60 million that Bayern wants? What's to stop them from offering 30 to 40 million? Nothing. Even worse, if Bayern does want to play hardball and they want to go down this road and Real Madrid refuses to pay, then Bayern becomes stuck with Davies, who doesn't want to be there, who then has to play out the last year of his deal, and then he'll leave for free, and Bayern Munich will lose the opportunity to cash out on what is a pretty valuable asset. So yeah, this has not been a great situation at all for Bayern Munich, to be honest. I don't know that laying out the ultimatum was the right thing to do, especially with it leaking to the media. I mean, if this is even true, and I'm assuming it is, because we've seen some reports indicate that this kind of thing was on the table, that this was a best and final offer that Bayern Munich made. And if it does play out this way, and Davies does reject the contract, I think Bayern's going to have a hell of a time getting as much as $40 million for Davies, because Real Madrid is not going to budge. They know that Davies wants to join them. They know that they don't have to budge. And they know that they're more than willing to sit 1 year and let him come for free, because let's be honest, they could still roll with what they're doing right now and be a great club. They could bring in another left back at a lesser price just to fill the void for a year. There are options. So for Real Madrid, this is a win-win scenario. For Bayern Munich, it's a terrible situation. So for Alphonso Davies, though, he's going to get what he wants. If this is truly what he wants, if he wants to go out and build his brand and his platform and he wants to leave Bayern Munich, it seems like he's going to get that opportunity. And we'll see. We'll see what stories break in about a week stating whether Alphonso Davies has accepted that offer or whether he has moved on. I'll be very interested to see. I mean, you know how I feel about it. I think Davies has already moved on. He's checked out and moved on, and then he wants to play for Real Madrid. Hopefully I'm wrong, because I would sure as hell love to be watching him and hopefully watch him rediscover that magic that he had, because he's still a very, very good, a borderline great player, still one of the top five left backs in the world. And I think he hasn't made any progress. So just imagine if he does rediscover things and finds a way to keep improving and to keep progressing. It would really be something special, especially given the overall talent level that he has. So I'm going to cross my fingers and hope things work out. But the realistic side of me tells me that this probably is not going to work out in the favor of Bayern Munich or its fans. We're going to take one more break, and then we'll have a last segment here before we wrap up. And we're going to go back and we're going to look at the Julian Nagelsmann saga from last year, because after all, we are on the 1 year anniversary, I believe it was Saturday, of the sacking heard around the world where Nagelsmann was unceremoniously dumped on a ski trip and man had to find out through the media that he was sacked. So hang with us. We're going to take a quick break. We'll be right back.
When you need mealtime inspiration, it's worth shopping Kroger, where you'll find over 30,000 mouthwatering choices that excite your inner foodie. And no matter what tasty choice you make, you'll enjoy our everyday low prices, plus extra ways to save, like digital coupons worth over $600 each week. You can also save up to $1 off per gallon at the pump with fuel points. More savings and more inspiring flavors make shopping Kroger worth it every time. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Fuel restrictions apply.
Hey, everybody. Welcome back to Bavarian Podcast Works. This is Chuck Smith. This is our final segment of the flagship show. And I did want to go back, because we are on that 1 year anniversary of Julian Nagelsmann getting sacked by Bayern Munich. And I wanted to talk about what it was like at the time, what you felt like, what I felt like, how things have progressed since then. And end with the question, is Bayern Munich better off for having removed him from being the coach of the club? Now, I've told this story a couple of times where I was driving to Virginia with my daughter. She had soccer games in Virginia, and we were on the road and my phone started to blow up, and it was BFW here, BFW there. There are rumors Nagelsmann's getting sacked. I was like totally caught off guard, because I did not expect anything like that to happen. I left my house, had my bags packed, was prepared for a pretty chill weekend where I wasn't going to have to do too much for BFW, do my normal stuff, maybe contribute a little bit here and there, but they were heading into an international break. So there was no real pressure for any big news to break. And then damn, everything went crazy. It was all going down as I was driving, embarking on a 4.5 to 5 hour drive, and I could do nothing to help anybody at BFW. So I always credit the staff for that time and for the rallying they did. Not only did they cover everything as the news was dropping, but they put out a pot emergency podcast as well. So much was going on. So I appreciate the way they handled it, but I remember that. And I remember thinking, like, what in the hell is going on? Why is this move being made right now? And as it would turn out, there was a lot going on at the time. And I wrote a little bit about this over the weekend, where we looked at the start of February and why things happened the way they did. So from February 1st onward, before he got sacked, Bayern Munich had played 10 games. They had 8 wins and 2 losses in that stretch. Of course, the 2 losses, one was to Borussia Mönchengladbach and the fateful loss to Bayer Leverkusen that ended up being Nagelsmann's last game. So it wasn't as if this was a horrible stretch. It wasn't as if this was, you know, those were 2 losses against 2 clubs where you would really have to go out and the front office would have to rattle their sabers and make a change. No. It was not, there was nothing indicating that there was a massive issue with either of those 2 losses. Now, over the course of that season, of course, things were not great. Nagelsmann, in his first year, had really, I thought, struggled to work with the roster. He had put the focus on players like Leroy Sané and Serge Gnabry to be the main features of the attack rather than Robert Lewandowski. And as we all know, that ticked off Lewandowski so much that he ended up leaving the next season. So you had that first season where Bayern was still successful. They won the league, nothing in the Pokal, nothing in the Champions League. So Nagelsmann got the 1 trophy. And from there, this was a 5-year project, right? He had a 5-year contract. We were expecting to see the next step up. So even though over the course of his second season, there was a lot of reason for concern, it seemed like even right up until the day he got fired that things were at least okay. Now, if you scroll back to the beginning of that season, of course, we talk about Robert Lewandowski leaving. Sadio Mane comes in. He's a complete bust, really not impactful. He actually became disruptive in a bad way. We all remember the going after Julian Nagelsmann in the locker room. I believe that was in the first match against PSG. Then he punched Leroy Sané in another match or after another match. So we had that whole issue. Clearly, there were locker room issues there. And there was up and down play throughout that year because Nagelsmann had decided once Lewandowski left, he was going in and going strikerless. And everybody that was around the team at that point, covering the team, observing the team day to day, I mean, it was pretty, there was a pretty universal opinion that this could be a massive mistake. And after the team started out relatively well, there were some really down games where things looked bad. And people started to question whether Nagelsmann was going to be the right person to lead the club moving forward. But every time it got bad or it looked bad, it would then cycle back up. And once Nagelsmann started to figure things out, he started to figure out that Sadio Mane was cooked. He started to figure out that he needed some sort of striker in the lineup, even if it was Eric Maxim Choupo-Moting. He needed somebody to play that hitman role. When he figured out that he needed Thomas Muller in the lineup to play with Jamal Musiala, then that would be his best option. Great. He finally got to that point where he realized, I need Muller. He brings out the best in Musiala. I need Musiala in the lineup. I need a hitman like Choupo-Moting to at least fill that role. And from there, I can work with everything. And he got to the point, he really did. And even though they lost the Leverkusen game, he had something clicked for him and he had figured it out. And I truly believe that he was going to go down that road and continue onward on the right path to getting the best out of the team. But as we all know, Brazo, the sporting director at the time, and Oliver Kahn, the CEO, once they had that loss to Leverkusen and they had the international break, they panicked. Now, if you believe Nagelsmann, he was accused of not being in the office after the Leverkusen game. He claims he was. He claims it was other people who he did not name. We can assume who he's talking about that were not in the office. So there's a little contradiction there, that story. With Nagelsmann, though, after he put in a couple of days in the office, he decided to go on a ski trip. And apparently then that is what pushed Brazo and Khan over the edge. So they had one that Nagelsmann, they felt like wasn't getting the best out of the team. They felt like he maybe had lost touch with the team. And then they did not like the results that they had seen, especially over what I'm assuming those last 10 games where they lost to Leverkusen and Borussia Mönchengladbach. Again, only two losses in those 10 games. And they were clearly still alive in all three competitions, the Bundesliga, the Pokal, and the Champions League. So everything was still there to play for. But there was one other factor that they did not like, aside of Nagelsmann and his inner workings with the team and the fact that he had left for a ski trip. The one thing that was hanging out there was that Thomas Tuchel was available, that he was a free agent, that he could be someone who could step in and coach a team. And for whatever reason, and I know Tuchel's a good coach, and don't get me wrong, I get slammed all the time in the comments at BFW for people that think I think Tuchel stinks as a coach. I do not think that. I'll reiterate this point one last time for anyone who has wax in their ears. Tuchel is a good coach. He was not the right coach for Bayern Munich at that time, nor this season. And I don't know how much more evidence you need of that, but that's just the way it is. Whether you love Tuchel, whether he's your boy, I don't know. But let's get it out there. He wasn't the right fit, because if he was, they'd have been a whole hell of a lot more successful. It doesn't mean he's a bad coach. Listen, you cannot be a bad coach and take that Chelsea team that he had and get them to win the Champions League. Let's be very clear about that. Tuchel proved he's a good coach with that mess of a bunch that he won the Champions League with. But not every great coach is a fit in every environment, and surely Tuchel was not. But back to the point, the two executives could not resist Tuchel. They could not pass up the opportunity. They could not miss it and let the opportunity to get Tuchel to come in and be the coach of their team. They couldn't let it pass by. So rather than risk Tuchel moving on and perhaps signing with another club, they panicked. They got rid of Julian Nagelsmann after a year and a half. A year and a half of what was supposed to be a five-year project. And I am not Mr. Pro Nagelsmann. I thought Nagelsmann had figured it out, but I thought it took him too long. I thought in his first season, he made some really serious mistakes, including how he worked with Robert Lewandowski, what his ideas were for the attack, some of his personnel decisions. I was not fully on board with Nagelsmann, but what I was willing to do was give it a chance. And I wanted to see three seasons of Nagelsmann. I never thought we would get one and a half and that would be it. So Tuchel comes in, he replaces Nagelsmann, and quite frankly, the season goes to hell. They get knocked out of the Pokal, which I don't know how you can excuse the guy for that. He was the head coach. And sure, was he put in a bad position? Yes. Sure he was. But at that point, your coaching reputation, I mean, all the brilliance that is upon you when he is there that you're expecting to him to put on his team, it didn't show up. It didn't click. It didn't connect. And that's because Brazo and Khan made a terrible mistake. They assumed that because a man was a good coach, that he was going to be able to come in and just work with the team, a team full of grizzled veterans, young upstarts, one that had been damaged from the inside of the locker room with the addition of Sadio Mane. There was a lot of unhappiness. We had Ryan Gravenberch whining and crying the whole season about playing time. There was a lot going on that I think people forgot about. So to bring Tuchel in, it might not have been fair for him to be put in that spot, but he took the job and he wanted the job. He had no problems taking it. So I do hold him accountable. They lost in the Pokal. They ran into a juggernaut of a Man City side in the Champions League. Would Nagelsmann have done anything differently there? I don't know. I'd like to think so, but I don't know. And of course, we all know how the Bundesliga season ended. Jamal Musiala saved Tuchel's hide in the waning seconds of the season with a goal because Borussia Dortmund Oh, man. They just went full dormant, right? So at the end of the season, we're all worried about Tuchel. I was completely beside myself because I had never had a good feeling about this. And listen, I've had my share of many wrong moments, many wrong predictions for sure. Never really liked the fit of Tuchel. Coming into this season, it started out in a bad way. We had seen open criticism of players. We had seen a lot of stories dropping about players. Tuchel openly talking about replacing players. These were all things that happened in interviews. So all of this happening in the summer, it did. And no one will convince me otherwise. You can try. But it absolutely alienated players like Joshua Kimmich, Leon Goretzka, Nusar Mazraoui, Matthijs de Ligt. You can't say those kind of things about players and expect players, even though they're professionals, not to have some kind of personal feeling to it. So Tuchel started out in a bad way this season, and it didn't really get better. You know, we talked about this all in the beginning of the season, and I had to endure the endless arguments about a win is a win. And I saw it with my own eyes that the team wasn't functioning well. The Tuchel wasn't making the right decisions. He wasn't pushing the right buttons, and he wasn't implementing the right strategies. It wasn't clicking. And part of that's because there was no relationship between the locker room and the coach that was anything substantial. It wasn't going to be enough to power through when things went wrong. So while they were winning games, it wasn't convincing. The players knew it. The coaches sure as hell knew it. Everybody knew it. Fans knew it. There was only a small segment of people that would continue to push this narrative, a win is a win. Until it wasn't, until it all fell apart and things looked horrible. And Tuchel finally, at some point, he couldn't pull the group back up until the club was forced to make a move. And that was to sever ties with Thomas Tuchel after the season. Now, it might sound like I'm bashing Tuchel, but I'm more bashing Khan and Brazo because they didn't make the right call. They didn't think through it. They didn't know for sure that Tuchel was going to be able to fit with the locker room, and he clearly was not. Now, did everything that Tuchel do at Bayern Munich, was it bad? No, absolutely not. He played a massive role in bringing in Harry Kane. Immense. That was terrific. I mean, maybe Nagelsmann could have gotten that done. Probably not. We don't know. We know that Tuchel's relationship going back to his days at Chelsea and being in England definitely helped. So he didn't just come in and mess things up completely. They did win some big games. They did win more games than they lost. It's not an indictment of Tuchel's coaching skills. It's an indictment of his coaching style and his ability to relate to this particular group. It wasn't going to work. It was never going to work. And unfortunately, Oliver Kahn and Brazo made that call and forever changed the course of Bayern Munich's history. It worked out last season only in that they won the Bundesliga in the waning seconds. Had Jamal Musiala misfired, as he had done so many times prior to that when he slumped in the second half of the season, or had Dortmund not completely choked it up, this would be potentially two straight seasons of no trophies for Bayern Munich. And really, all six of the losses could potentially be with Thomas Tuchel at the helm. And when I say six of the losses, I mean the ultimate games. So obviously, we're sitting here a year later. What would you have done? Would you have still made that call had you lost that much faith in Nagelsmann that you would have still lopped him off and let him go and rolled the dice with Tuchel? Or would you have stuck with Nagelsmann? Would you have wanted to see him finish out the project or at least give him 3 years to make it work? I know I would have liked to have ridden with Nagelsmann just a little bit longer. I was willing to give him at least that second season and probably the third. And as I said, I wasn't even the biggest Nagelsmann fan. I'm surely not the biggest Tuchel fan, but I can respect that both guys are indeed, and I will say this in full belief, I totally believe the statement, they are very good coaches. They know the game. They're good tacticians. They're good strategists. Where I think both guys need some work is relating to players, understanding players, understanding how to communicate with the media. That's where I think they need some work. When it comes to the actual football, they make some good choices. They make some bad ones. But more often than not, they guide winning teams. So I sit here a year later, and yeah, I would have stuck with Julian Nagelsmann. And it was really, in my mind, and I think it's proven to be true, a big mistake to have let him go. And now the next chapter of Bayern Munich will begin for next season. There'll be another new coach who will have to come in, have to establish himself, have to work with a roster that is part grizzled veterans, part young players, and have to build relationships while also being a master tactician. Good luck to whoever that is. If it's Xabi Alonso, he'll have a leg up on everyone else. He is probably the one guy that could come in and make an instant impact. But if it's not him, man, that next coach might have it rough. That'll about end this episode of Bavarian Podcast Works. I want to hear what you think about that. I did get some of the feedback through the post I wrote about that one-year anniversary of Nagelsmann, but I would love to hear more and more from the podcast audience just because this is such a controversial topic. I know we have so many Nagelsmann fans out there and so many Tuchel fans, and you probably both hate some of what I said, but I think in the end we can all agree, even though they're good coaches, sometimes they're just not the best fit for what Bayern Munich needs. So appreciate everybody tuning in. I know you're probably getting sick of my voice. Hopefully you're not, but I enjoy being here and enjoy talking Bayern Munich and the German national team with you. As always, you can get me at the Barrel Blog on Twitter. You can get the site at Bavarian FB Works. You can get this podcast at Bavarian Podcast. You can get I Need No Name at BFWINNN. You can get our tweet Meister Tom Adams at TommyAdams71. And you can get Siler at BFW Siler. Check out BavarianFootballWorks.com for all of our great podcasters and writers. We will be continuing on with our German national team coverage while also diving hard into Bayern Munich and everything as they start to ramp back up later this week. Enjoy your work week. Oh man, I hate saying that. Have a couple of beers on me, and we'll see you next time.